from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. This morning, after a two-week recess, Congress is back in session. House investigators will hear testimony today from President Trump's former Russia advisor, Fiona Hill, about the Ukraine scandal. And later this week, U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, is expected to testify on the question of whether there was a quid pro quo in the president's interactions with the Ukrainian president. Meanwhile, President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria has led to massive balance of power shifts on the ground and continues to draw bipartisan rebukes in Washington. We'll talk about all the latest coming up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to the Forum program. Yesterday, President Trump ordered remaining U.S. forces out of northern Syria, a decision that's having broad consequences on the ground as Syrian troops have reportedly moved to the border to confront Turkish forces, and hundreds of ISIS family members are said to have fled a camp in northern Syria. Domestically, the events are drawing bipartisan criticism of Trump's policy, as congressional investigators, meanwhile, are set to hear more testimony this week in their ongoing impeachment inquiry. And we're going to talk about this morning's headlines with Eric Schmidt. I welcome him to the program. He's senior national security correspondent with The New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Joins us from his Washington, D.C. office. And welcome, Eric Schmidt. Glad to have you with us.
Good to be back with you, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll also welcome back Jessica Taylor, political reporter with NPR. Jessica, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Scott Schaefer, who is also in Washington this morning, our senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of Political Breakdown, a weekly radio program. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, Michael.
Hi to you. And let me begin, Eric Schmidt, if I may, with you. All of this withdrawal now from northeast Syria in recent days is really causing not only mass confusion, but also massacres and more civilians and more Kurd allies of ours, once allies of ours, are dying, and more ISIS members, whatever member, family members, I wanted to say, are actually being held, who were being held or escaping. What I want to really get to here is, though, is the unpredictability of this. It's constantly shifting, and I think Jim Mattis is right, former defense secretary, when he says there's going to be a real ISIS resurgence as a result of all this. It seems to be on its way.
I think that's right. And what's happened here is over the last several months since the last shards of the caliphate, the Islamic State's caliphate or religious state, were defeated, ISIS was driven underground, but it still had thousands of fighters both in Iraq and Syria. And so it was important for the U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish militia, the SDF as it's called, to continue their counterterrorism work with the United States. Now, with the Kurds having to basically fear for their lives and focus north on the advancing Turkish offensive, the U.S. no longer has a partner on the ground to combat ISIS, and ISIS is taking advantage of that, as you point out.
And Turkey has actually taken control of a main highway there, a key highway, which allows actually Turkish troops and their proxies to block supply lines. And also, at this point, it makes it more difficult for U.S. troops to leave and makes it almost impossible to get through to Iraq, doesn't it?
That's right. The U.S. is basically has positions now that are cut off from different parts of the northeastern part of Syria. They'll have to be flown out, and this obviously increases the risk as you have these Turkish-backed militias of their own that are the advancing force that have gone into northeastern Syria, as you said, carrying out, by many accounts, certain atrocities along the way, shooting different Kurdish civilians and fighters as they go, and you've got obviously mortars and artillery airstrikes overhead. So it's become a very dangerous and messy proposition for the remaining troops that are beginning, the remaining American troops that are beginning their evacuation now over the coming days.
Eric Schmidt with us, again, senior national security correspondent with The New York Times. And Eric, I have to ask you about what this does in terms of national security vis-a-vis our relationships with our allies. I'm not only talking about the Kurds, which many people feel has been a betrayal of the worst order, but the abandonment of the Kurds. But what about, the president said, after all, they didn't fight in Normandy. But what does this do, with European allies, particularly since they don't see us as very reliable now, do they?
Well, again, this is the second time now in 10 months that the U.S. has basically pulled the rug out from under allies who the U.S. begged and pleaded to join them. The French, the British, other European allies whose special forces are on the ground fighting alongside the Americans and the Syrian Kurdish fighters, they also got no warning this was going to be happening. And after December, they were wary. You can imagine how they must feel now in the next time the U.S. needs allies in a pinch, whether it's in the Middle East or in Africa or in Asia, they're obviously going to have second thoughts about coming along.
And it comes on the heels of really not going against Iran with Saudi Arabia and a few other things that we could mention here. But let me go to Jessica Taylor on this. Jessica Taylor, the president at one time was talking about really crushing the Turkish economy if they went this far. I think they have already gone this far and in terms of massacres. And now Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, and others are talking about sanctions. Sanctions against Turkey would amount to really what, particularly in light of the fact we don't do that much trade with Turkey?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question is he can fall. Trump seems to fall back on these economic sanctions as wanting to pressure them. But then you look at just, I mean, how much of this has been decimated just over the past week when we pulled out and this just massive shift in the region. And I mean, he's losing support among, I mean, it seemed like there was nothing he could do wrong, even as this impeachment inquiry was beginning to lose Republicans, but he's losing Republicans over this. He's losing even some evangelicals have really criticized him because you have the Kurds are our allies. They see this as a religious persecution issue. And so he's deeply being criticized there. And, you know, the question is, how much could this even impact Turkey? As you said, they're not a major trading partner by any means. And so I think that it's just they sort of seem this was the Trump likes to make sort of these rash decisions, not listening to his larger military allies and his advisors. And so when you saw people around him that I think were keeping him these guardrails in a way, like Jim Mattis earlier, and he stepped down when it seemed like Trump was going to take this step late last year. And now that he's done this, we see just the ramifications of how it's shifted in just the past week.
Well, there are Republicans backing him. I know they're talking about the fact that Congress wasn't in session, implying maybe that the Congress, which is dominated by Democrats, should have really taken more action here and that the president is stopping a forever war, as he has said many times. But what happens when Lindsey Graham starts talking about massacres and when Ted Cruz criticizes the president for his statements about China, which Jim Jordan just dismissed as a joke?
Well, I mean, Graham is one of the more interesting ones that I'm watching on here because he is someone that, you know, I mean, of course, going back to the 2016 campaign, he ran against Trump. He was incredibly critical of him. He was then an ally of the now late Senator John McCain. And, you know, one of the reasons that he gave for sort of buddying up to Trump and becoming close to him is because he felt like he could really influence him on military policy. And he is very much a hawk. And so I think it raises the question of, okay, if this was one of Lindsey Graham's main ways to try to influence Trump on foreign policy and on military policy specifically, he's a JAG lawyer. He has not been successful in this. So, you know, what kind of influence does Lindsey Graham still have over him in that regard? I mean, yes, you have more libertarian leaning senators that and that sort of wing of the party that will praise him as sort of pulling out for war. But when you look at the larger implications and the national security implications, when you're losing all these ISIS prisoners and ISIS fighters, I mean, Trump has touted very much before that, you know, I ended ISIS, we've defeated them and everything too. But I mean, this leads to sort of a different uprising, and how this could impact the 2020 campaign, I think, has massive implications as well. Because I mean, Trump wants to run as the, you know, national security president, the law and order president. But when you have this happening overseas, and with ISIS reemerging, they represent a major threat to not only our interests abroad, but here at home as well.
They keep saying the caliphate is gone. And yet, the fact of the matter is, if you have some of these ISIS escapees going back to Europe, or making their way back to Europe, and Europe will not admit them, most of the European countries won't, you're going to have even more chaos and more of the kind of horror that we saw before many of them were under Kurdish control. I want to bring our own Scott Schaefer into this. And Scott, of course, is senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Scott, on Saturday, there was $50 million that was promised to stabilize things in Syria. What is that money actually going to? Do we know?
Well, I don't think we know quite yet, but what this whole crisis is doing is giving Republicans a chance to criticize the president in ways that they can't around impeachment, and I know we're going to get to that later. But, you know, you mentioned Lindsey Graham. There's someone else who I think whose criticism has been very notable. Brett McGurk, who was in charge of defeating ISIS until General Jim Mattis stepped down as defense secretary, tweeted out this weekend that Donald, and I'm quoting here, Donald Trump is not a commander in chief. He makes impulsive decisions with no knowledge of deliberation. It's almost a little bit like no matter what the money is going to be earmarked for, it's a little bit like closing the barn door after the horses get out. I mean, this is a crisis that was completely self-imposed by the decision to withdraw precipitously from Syria. And now, based on criticism he's getting from his allies and his friends, you know, Donald Trump is trying to put the genie back into the bottle. But it's the damage is being done as we speak, and you can't just undo it with additional aid to shore up this group or that.
Could this indeed be another article of impeachment or an inquiry for the impeachment inquiry that's going on about the United States losing its connections, its allies, its integrity, its trust in foreign policy, all of that above?
It could be. I mean, as you know, the House under the Constitution is granted very broad authority to bring impeachment charges based on issues ranging from treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. That's fairly vague. And I know we've heard a lot of criticism from Republicans about the process, the fact that there hasn't been a full vote in the House to get this inquiry going. None of those things are prescribed in the or are required in the Constitution. And it's interesting because you're seeing the criticism of Democrats here. It's not so much in it's not defending the president from, for example, the phone call he made to the president of Ukraine. It's more complaints about the process or criticizing the whistleblower or calling on his questioning his patriotism or her patriotism. We just don't know. I think that's really worth watching in all of this is just what exactly Republicans are criticizing.
Let me bring Eric Schmidt back. And Eric, I want to go back to, what's unfolding here in terms of Syria and the Kurds, because to some extent, the Kurds have now apparently made an alliance with Syria. And I wonder what that bodes. And also, even though other governments have pressed Erdogan to sit down with the Kurds and actually do some negotiating, he has said they're terrorists. I'm not going to sit down with them. I'm not going to let terrorists actually move into northeast Syria. And he seems absolute on this to sort of seal the deal. But what does it mean now that the Kurds have allied themselves possibly with Assad?
Well, it's a big deal, and one that U.S. diplomats and commanders that I've spoken to over the last several weeks and months have feared could happen if, in the event, something like what's just happened over the last week took place. That is, the Kurds are facing, a much larger offensive in the Turkish army and their militias coming south. If they're not going to have American support, they need some other power to help them on the ground. So they've always kept in communication with the Syrian regime. There have been deals for oil, for instance. And so this is kind of a last-ditch effort to stave off, you know, them best being slaughtered, I think. And so you've got this deal being cut with the Syrian regime. And, of course, along when you sign up with the Syrians, you get the Russians. And that will definitely give the Turks something, you know, something to pause on.
And indeed, excuse me, Eric, this just plays into Putin's hands, really. I mean, it opens things up for the Iranians, too, make no mistake about that, but it has to be completely seen in italics here, as much as we can visualize them, that this really is what Putin wants.
Oh, no, Putin comes out of this a huge winner, along with President Assad of Syria and the Iranians. Not only do they get this territory back, but if you go further to the east, past the city of Deir Ezzor, these huge oil fields that have so far been controlled by the Kurds and their U.S. partners, that will all now revert back to Syrian control, presumably. And so, this is a big win for Assad and for Putin. And as you mentioned, Erdogan feels completely emboldened here. There's nobody stopping him, so he continues to push south on a long stretch of the border. And he basically has said, I'm not going to negotiate right now while this offensive is underway.
Eric Schmidt, always good to have you with us. Appreciate very much your being with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Eric Schmidt, senior national security correspondent of the New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike. Let me go back to you, Jessica Taylor, and let's talk about what's ahead with the impeachment inquiry. You're going to have testimony by the EU ambassador this week, actually today, in fact, and you're also going to have the former Russian advisor Fiona Hill up on the Hill testifying. What can we expect? What do you see?
Well, I mean, Fiona Hill is someone who she's not a Trump ally. She has been, you know, she's a Russia expert, and that's what she was brought in for the Security Council. She served under past administrations, both Republican and Democrat. And, you know, I think that they want to know if she stepped down actually from the National Security Council right before this call in question with the Ukrainian president happened. And so I think that, you know, they want to know what was happening beforehand, what she can tell them about that. She is there right now. We don't know sort of what her testimony is involving right now and how much of that may come out, because this is in a private setting. You have Sondland that will testify later this week. You know, he was supposed to testify last week. The White House blocked that. Later in the day, they put out this just incredibly partisan letter from the White House counsel's office saying that, you know, they did not have to cooperate with this, and framing it in just incredibly partisan terms in a way that we would not typically see from a White House counsel that is supposed to be protecting the presidency and not necessarily the president. So Sondland is going to come forward. The Washington Post actually reported over the weekend that he will say that, you know, there was question about some of these text messages that he sent back and forth, and saying that, you know, there was no sort of quid pro quo, that he was told by the president to say this. And, you know, he will say, you know, there may have been, but it wasn't corrupt necessarily. So I think that, you know, the question is, how much is he moving away from sort of the Trump and the White House line of questioning? He does not want to be the fall guy. I think all of these people that are testifying, they don't want to be the fall guy. They're turning around, they're pointing fingers. Certainly, I think it raises the question of just the influence that Rudy Giuliani has had in all of this. And you're seeing just a great concern from all of these career foreign service people or career foreign policy officials of how much the president's outside counsel lawyer, who does not have security clearance, was not employed by the White House, was not employed by the State Department, was having this sort of undue pressure on White House foreign policy when it comes to Ukraine.
Let's talk about that undue pressure with you, Scott Schaefer, because it's pretty clear at this point that Rudy Giuliani was looking not only for dirt, as the president may have been in his discussion, or almost certainly was, with the president of Ukraine, dirt on the Bidens, but also there's an interesting wrinkle to this that I don't think has been perhaps spotlighted as much as it should be, and that is the belief somehow that the Ukrainians, who were against the Russians, the previous administration, was sort of in league against Trump in the election and in the campaign and so forth, and maybe has information that Trump could prove that they were against him.
You know, I think what we're seeing is the old playbook that we saw in 2016. There's no evidence that Hunter Biden or Joe Biden did anything wrong in Ukraine. Now, you can say, why was the vice president's son advising a foreign government? And Hunter Biden did say he's stepping down from a Chinese equity firm at the end of the month. But what's happening, I think, is that you see the president.
Forgive me, Scott. A lot of people are also asking, how did he get on a board paying $50,000 a month?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a legitimate question. But the point is, you know, as the president focuses on this and Republicans focus on this, it diverts attention away from other things, like what was the president doing and asking for on the phone with the Ukrainian president. And, you know, tomorrow night there's a debate with the leading Democratic candidates for president. Hunter Biden has given a interview to ABC News, which is going to air just before the debate. So that you can tell now that the debate, a lot of that time is going to be taken up talking about this. That is exactly what I think President Trump and the Republicans would like.
Well, Vice President Biden has said, I'm not going to have anybody in my family under any circumstances as part of an administration if I'm elected.
Right. But the fact that he's, you know, if you're explaining something, you're losing.
Yeah.
And that said, there's the old Elton John song, you know, I'm still standing.
Yeah.
And he is still first in the polls. But I think there are increasing questions about his viability as a nominee, both in his slowness and the way in which he counterattacked when Trump raised this issue. And, you know, is he really up to the task of being the nominee? And I'm not saying he's not, but I think there are a lot of questions being raised. And I think the debate tomorrow night, as this issue comes out again, will be another step toward answering that question. And I would just say, I think it is in some ways an echo. I said it's the 2016 playbook, because if you look back at the media coverage of the 2016 election, so much of the coverage of Hillary Clinton was about her email. And and or negative. About 75-80% of the coverage of her was negative. And I think we're beginning to see something like that happening with Joe Biden. And that's what I mean. It's a play, sort of the playbook from 2016 all over again.
Well, as long as you're talking about 2016, let me bring Jessica Taylor back in, political reporter for NPR, because has there been any real movement forward from the House of Representatives or elsewhere about election safety or reform about election security as the election looms?
Well, House Democrats certainly want to move on this, and they have tried to push reforms and things. But then you have the Senate that is still controlled by Republicans that does not want to move on it. And you've seen Mitch McConnell block a lot of those measures. And so I think that there is a real question of how seriously Republicans are taking this. And, you know, we still have, you know, questions about even viability about, you know, voting measures and how secure some of these voting booths or things are just voting systems in general, because we saw hacks in Florida and different places. And so I think that, you know, we really have not moved very far when we look. We are 3 years almost past this, and we've known that this has been a problem, and the administration does not want to earmark money for this. And so really, I don't think we've made many strides in moving forward this, even though it was very much an issue in 2016, certainly.
And even though it was certainly emphasized dramatically by Robert Mueller, and
right.
He didn't emphasize that many things dramatically, but he did that.
Right.
We're coming up on
a
break.
Well, I mean, you have the president who doubts that it still happens.
That's right. I want to give out the number, and I want to ask another question of Scott, but let me give out the number and invite those of you listening to join us, because we do want you to participate in this conversation, and we do want to hear from you. And you can give us a call right now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786, as we discuss the news and political news and review, but also not only national news, what's going on in Syria. Lend your voice. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have or comments to forum@kqed.org. And Scott, before we go to this break, can you talk about how impeachment inquiry is going to affect the seven freshman California Democrats?
Yeah, well, you know, these seven freshmen got elected in large measure by focusing not on Donald Trump in 2018, but by focusing on health care and other bread and butter issues that voters really care about. And I think this entire impeachment process is testing that. You know, will they be able to go out, run for reelection, talk to voters at the town halls that they do, and focus on the things that voters really care about? Now, maybe as time goes on and we learn more about this whole process, voters are going to care more about impeachment than they do today. But I think it is going to test that. That said, for example, one of those freshmen, Katie Porter, who is down on the coast, Orange County, she raised more than $1 million in the third quarter, as she did in the second quarter. So as a freshman, she's doing very well raising money. Other freshmen are as well. Gil Cisneros, another freshman down in Orange County, was one of the seven freshmen who signed that bill, that op-ed in the Washington Post urging an impeachment inquiry. He had military background and intelligence background, as the others did. So, you know, they're holding their own at the moment, but we're very much far from the end of this story.
Talking about politics, talking about national news, about impeachment in Syria. And again, if you'd like to be part of the program, you can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. That number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. And also, you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Continue with Scott Schaefer and Jessica Taylor. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about national politics and what's in the news. We started out talking about Syria with Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, and now we're really focusing to a great deal on the impeachment and other matters that concern us in the political world. Jessica Taylor with us, political reporter from NPR, and Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of Political Breakdown. I want to read a couple of comments that are coming in, which sort of go against perhaps what you've heard thus far. Carl writes, I support Trump on Syria. It was President Obama who made the decision to do nothing to remove the dictator Assad from power. The European powers all have armies that can be there in Syria. It is their backyard if they want to stand between Turkey and the Kurds. And Mike writes, I heard Senator Rand Paul on Meet the Press yesterday. It's a strange time for our republic when he's the only one who makes sense. We should mention that Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has been long in favor of moving out of the Middle East and just about everywhere else. In other words, stopping these what President Trump has called forever wars. So to sort of give some balance here in terms of other opinions, and there are opinions that certainly go counter to what you're hearing from our best journalists, and you may want to weigh in here. I do have an opinion about something, however, that I'd like to weigh in on and hear perhaps from you on this, Jessica, and you, Scott, as well, and that is this fake video that was a part of a New York Times story. It was the Church of Fake News, and it showed Donald Trump essentially mowing down, brutally killing and maiming and knifing and just about every other savagery kind of you can imagine, all of those in the media and particularly in the major media. And they were claiming, that is, down in Florida where this meeting took place, that they had nothing to do with it, that is, the GOP and so forth, and they didn't know about it. What do you read here? Let me go first to you, Jessica.
Yeah, so this was a pro-Trump group that had a conference at Trump's Doral Resort in Miami, which is where he's talked about holding the G12 summit next year. This New York Times came out with a story last night. The video did surface on Twitter. I watched it right before I went to bed, which I think was not wise. It's an incredibly disturbing video.
It's very chilling, really chilling.
Yeah. It comes from a movie, and they have superimposed, news logos, Politico, Washington Post, CNN, NPR is on there. And Trump is shown as shooting and killing and shooting people in the head. And John McCain is in there. It's incredibly disturbing. I mean, you know,
Rosie O'Donnell is in there.
Yeah, I mean, he's tweeted out these memes before of him, you know, roundhouse kicking CNN or things too. But I mean, this goes to a different level, and it's in a church. I mean, we have had shootings in churches. We have had shootings now in newsrooms. 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't really worry about my safety as a journalist. But if I go out on the trail, even if I come here to work, I mean, it's something that is at the back of your mind because we have become so demonized as a profession. I mean, you can debate whether that's, you know, whose fault that is. But I mean, the president has amped up his rhetoric against the media, and he has made essentially when he calls us fake news or enemies of the press, he has made that because he does not like our coverage.
Excuse me, enemies of the people, I think you mean.
Right. Sorry. Yes. Enemies of the people and he has made fake news synonymous with just things he doesn't like when there is real fake news out there that is a real problem. And it is our job. We are protected in the First Amendment. We are given these rights, and it is a vital part of our democracy to do our job, to fact check and to hold power accountable.
If I could just add on to what Jessica's saying,
Scott,
too, I think anybody who's ever covered a Trump rally or a campaign event, whatever, you get targeted by him verbally. He's up in front. He encourages people to look at the media and kind of shout at the media. This is just taking it several steps further than that. But it's also, I think, in keeping with what we've seen from this president in terms of undermining institutions, whether it's the judiciary, the FBI, the CIA, the media, of course. And it is troubling because it further drives a wedge between Americans, between people in this country. And if you get to the point where you cannot believe what the FBI or the CIA says, and I realize the FBI and the CIA don't have perfect histories. I'm not saying that they're perfect. But when you have these investigations or these concerns raised by legitimate law enforcement groups and individuals, and people just say that they don't believe it because it was in the media or because it was from the FBI, which is full of Democrats, I mean, I think all people in this country should be a little concerned about
it. President can just say, I'm draining the swamp, and we'll go to your calls. Let's start off, Barbara, with you. Barbara, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to speak about the threat to our elections because the reporter seemed to be a little bit uncertain about that. The real threat is that we have computerized our elections, and basically computers are now used in tabulating all of our votes. Even if you vote on paper ballots, those ballots are tabulated by scanners, which are computers. And because they are computers, they can be hacked, even if they are not connected to the Internet, because they have to be updated with the information about the current election, you know, the candidates, where they are on the ballot, and that is done by computers, separate computers, which frequently are connected to the Internet, and those computers can pass their viruses, if they get infected, onto the voting machines.
Barbara, you make a valuable point, an important point, and I want to go back to you on this, Jessica Taylor, because she's right. I mean, it's not only foreign powers we have to worry about, it's hackers just about everywhere. They're ubiquitous.
No, she's absolutely right. I mean, and there is a push to, you know, go back to sort of this paper tabulation, certainly. But I mean, I think just the, you know, everything that we do is on the internet, or, you know, just to if we want our election results fast or something, or be able to analyze them and see where these things happen. I mean, you have to use computers. We live in a computerized society. And so I think that that's why a lot of this push has been, you know, yes, there are people that want to, you know, at least some sort of paper record or things. And I think some type of record is a good idea. But also, I mean, we have to keep these things on computers in some form or fashion. So we have to find out some way that we can protect these better and, yes, protect them from hackers. And I mean, there are people out there that are trying to do this even within the U.S., certainly. But I mean, this is just the way that we operate now in the 21st century. And I think going forward, there's no way that you can do this without a computerized system.
Let me thank Barbara for that call and go right to Jeff as our next caller. Jeff, you're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I've got kind of a far-fetched hypothetical, and I wanted to get some what your thoughts are on it. We know that Donald Trump doesn't make decisions in a bubble. He doesn't do it for the benefit of the troops. He doesn't do it for the benefit of the country. But he went against every advisement when he pulled troops away from the Kurds. So my question is this. Is anybody looking at what information Turkey may have on Trump that he didn't want to get out?
Interesting thought. And also, Scott Schaefer, again, I go back to the point I made earlier with Eric Schmidt. This benefits Putin most of all. And certainly there's been lots of questions about how much Trump wants to win favor with Putin, not to even mention Erdogan.
Exactly. That is certainly true. And I think you could say the same with Ukraine, which has been trying to fend off Russia for several years now. And by threatening to withhold that military aid or seeming to, he did freeze it, President Trump did. It does raise questions about what's going on here. I mean, we have always in this country historically based our foreign policy and diplomacy based on strategy and multilateral, multinational cooperation and collaboration, and fundamentally what's in the best interest of our country and our allies. And I think what we're seeing here with Syria and perhaps in other cases as well, some real head-scratching, to say the very least, about what exactly is driving the president to make decisions which clearly are not in the best interest of our allies. I mean, the European Union today is going to begin an arms limited arms sales to Turkey because of this. Angela Merkel called Erdogan over the weekend and urged him to stop his incursion into Syria. So these are things that the U.S. president, for better or worse, has always taken the lead on. And now we're seeing other allies around the world or other countries taking the lead. And there's kind of a vacuum in a lot of ways in terms of the moral authority that the U.S. has had, I think, for many decades.
And again, we invite you to join the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. Here's a question from a listener, an email. Let me go to you, Jessica Taylor. Listener asks, can you explain the reported meeting between Attorney General William Barr and Rupert Murdoch? Now, there's a call for that meeting to be investigated.
Yeah, I'm not as read up on that, I will admit. But, I mean, you know, there is questions, I mean, about certainly if what that would be, because, I mean, you know, you have Trump that has certainly criticized Fox News at a new level because, you know, some of their hosts, and we had Shep Smith that stepped down on Friday, who was, I think, was one of the last, you know, sort of straight news voices on Fox News.
Excuse me, Jessica. You also have Rush Limbaugh recently, who used to be sort of the titular head of the Republican Party, criticizing Fox News for not being sharp enough in terms of supporting the president. And so all of this seems to bode a kind of shift of sorts. Now, with Roger Ailes gone, there's Rupert Murdoch, and he's meeting with A.G. Barr, who has been sort of a personal attorney for the president.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are just a lot of questions, certainly, about some of the things that Barr has done as attorney general. You know, he, you know, when the Mueller report came out, he, you know, put out this very short letter, sort of summarizing it, that we later found out was sort of not the whole story about what happens. But I mean, it's just a question of, you know, what interest would the attorney general have in meeting with this major media figure that is that has tried to protect Trump, and we have seen him over and over again. Again, it goes back to the same thing that, you know, we talked about before, that, you know, the White House counsel is not supposed to be the lawyer for the president. He's supposed to be the lawyer for the presidency. And the same thing is the attorney general is not supposed to be the lawyer for the president. He's supposed to be the lawyer for the entire country protecting the Justice Department. So I think it raises a lot of questions, as a lot of Barr's conduct has since he took office.
I come back to that quote of Trump's when he said, "Where's my Roy Cohen?" when Sessions was not coming across strongly enough for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to add to what Jessica said about Fox News, I mean, the president also tweeted some very disparaging things about Chris Wallace, saying he's not nearly as good a journalist as his father, Mike Wallace. And there was a Fox poll out, I think, over the weekend showing that Giuliani's favorability numbers were 31%, 53% unfavorable. These are from likely voters, even worse among independent voters. And so this is a case where even his own favorite news organization is reporting things based on polling and other just being journalists that the president is not happy about.
Yeah, I mean, he's gone after their poll specifically and questioned it. I mean, you can say what you want about Fox News and which way they lean, but their polls have been very accurate. I think that they have a very professional polling operation that is very respected within the wider polling community as well.
Couple questions from listeners. Let me go to you with this first one, Jessica. Pam writes, I've been hearing about the politics of impeachment for new Democratic members of Congress, but I'm curious about whether any Republicans have been getting pushback on their stance on impeachment. Any information on that?
I mean, I think that we, as you look at sort of, it's still so early, I think, in this, because, you know, we've talked about impeachment for, it feels like, a long time now, but this what happened here with Ukraine is such, I think, a clearer-cut example for many people than the Mueller report and the whole Russia involvement was, because you have a president here that is asking a foreign country to investigate his rival. It's very clear-cut, and I think that raises more alarm bells in a way. And so I think we are seeing, you know, people getting you've seen, you know, Joni Ernst in Iowa getting pressure on this. And I think that the senators, especially, because they will be the ones that you have the House that will vote to impeach, but then that does not remove Trump from office. You have the Senate that he has to get a two-thirds majority in order to remove, which has never happened in our country's history. Richard Nixon probably would have gotten there, but he resigned before that could have happened. And so it's just the question of whether this could move. I think public sentiment, we are seeing now that it is moving from where it has in critical independence, but then you do have Republicans. If they're in safe seats, I mean, they're not going to budge, I don't think, certainly, because that is not what their constituents want. They're going to be more worried about a primary challenge. And so, I mean, we have fewer Republicans that are in swing seats after the last election, certainly. There's a few. And I mean, you know, we see some that have stood up sort of on principle. Justin Amash, of course, came out in Michigan, and he ended up leaving the Republican Party because of this. So.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Scott. This is Richard who writes, let's be clear, the First Amendment speaks to what the government does against the free press, and that should control the president's attacks on the media. At some point, his attacks violate the First Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that. On the other hand, he has his own free speech rights.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But it's an interesting argument.
He can say what he wants. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's gotten a lot of attention. But, you know, the president has that as well. And, you know, he's not the first Republican or even any president to mm-hmm. criticize the media. I mean, Bill Clinton was not happy mm-hmm. with the way he was covered for many years. And George H.W. Bush also. I mean, there has been a longstanding antipathy, especially from Republican politicians. But
go back to Nixon.
Democrats. I mean, Nixon as well, with the enemies list and Dan Shore being on that and others. But, there is a history. It's just that Trump, as in so many cases, has taken it to a new level.
And we'll get another caller aboard here. That's you, Ryan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wonder whether it's worth considering that Trump, with the impeachment inquiry coming at him from all sides, might have precipitously pulled out U.S. troops from Syria in order to distract us from what's happening here. we can't read his mind, but isn't that a possibility?
Well, it's certainly a possibility that is forwarded by many. And Scott, your thoughts about it, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the thing is, I was thinking this morning about that kind of thing. And, you know, you have, you know, we went from no drama Obama to almost constant chaos and controversy, and it's head spinning. And so, yeah, today we're talking about Syria, but tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, Syria may be well in the rearview mirror, both because the president does have a way of dominating the news cycle, but also because our attention spans are a lot shorter than they used to be, and he's taking, I think, to a certain extent, advantage of that.
It's and the wag the dog scenario that happened in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Jessica Taylor, let me go back to you. A listener wants to know, what are lawmakers planning for the scope of the impeachment inquiry? Could it extend beyond the focus on Ukraine? And that's a big question, because there are those who say it should focus largely, if not disproportionately, on Ukraine. And yet you've got all these other committees investigating so many other things and still talk about the Mueller report and obstructions of justice of about the number 10.
You do have, I mean, you have questions about his taxes and whether, you know, there was a ruling that could move to force him to turn over those to committees. I mean, you know, there's been constant investigations and oversight, as was going to happen when you had control flipped of Congress. And when Republicans won control of Congress in 2010, they began investigating the Obama administration very much. So, I mean, this is nothing new when you have divided government. But I think the extent to which you have so many conflicts within the Trump administration is certainly new. And when you have a president that has not necessarily separated himself from his business interests, that's another question that I think is at the backdrop of this, too, when you look into Turkey, because Turkey, Trump has business interests in Turkey, the Trump Organization does as well. I think that it certainly seems like Pelosi wants to narrow this down. But when you have you know, this inquiry, I mean, it has not been voted on, which is another thing that the White House pushes back on, because it has not formally been voted on to begin an inquiry, which is what happened in Nixon and both in Clinton. You know, that's a question of, we don't know when we're going to get, you know, formal articles of impeachment coming forward, because right now this is under the umbrella of the Oversight Committee, of the Judiciary Committee, of the Intelligence Committee. So you have these three committees that are leading this. But when, I mean, I do think that Pelosi and leaders, because she was hesitant to come around to impeachment at all for this inquiry to happen, I think that they want to keep it focused and not sort of throwing everything at the wall, because I think that if they have a more focused reason, that is going to be easier to convince the American people and to move public sentiment.
Well, speaking about moving the American people and changing public sentiment, a lot in this Ukraine argument may hinge on Rudy Giuliani. And I'm wondering, Scott Schaefer, about your thoughts of his being called to testify. Remember that Don McGahn refused and to this point has continued to refuse to testify. He was the president's private lawyer. It was a different capacity, but nevertheless, is Giuliani just going to say, no, I'm not going to go testify?
He may well. We'll find out. I mean, this is, you know, his relationship with President Trump is extremely close, and he'll probably do whatever the president wants. There was a little daylight between them for a moment a few days ago when the president made some kind of odd comment about he wasn't sure whether Giuliani was still his personal attorney, but they had lunch together apparently to patch things up over the weekend.
You think he was ready to throw him under the bus and maybe change his mind?
You know, I think that if you look at the carnage of people who went to go work for this administration and what happened to them and how they left and how the I mean, just a day or two ago, he was still excoriating Jeff Sessions, who was his first attorney general. You know, there has been a long list of people who were in, John Bolton, another one more recently, who are in until they're out. And then they're out in a big way. And so would I be surprised if that happened to Rudy Giuliani? No.
Looking at a comment from Barbara, who wanted to correct the record here. She was our first caller. She says, I was the first person who called in. I was not saying that we shouldn't use computers. My point is that paper ballots provide a check against the tax on our elections if we use them to audit the scanners that tabulate the ballots. The National Academies and the Senate Intelligence Committee both recommended paper ballots. Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to you, Matt. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. It's a great conversation. I wanted to bring up a theory that I had heard that perhaps the murder of Jamal Khashoggi was some leverage that Erdogan would have against Trump, because Turkey was purported to have electronic surveillance of the embassy and may know that Trump or his family knew in advance or very soon afterwards what had happened. And that could be something that he could release against Trump.
Boy, that's a thought that I had not come across. It was in Turkey where Khashoggi was assassinated, and it was in the Saudi embassy. Scott, you want to opine on this?
Not really. I mean, it's just there's so many sort of conspiracy theories like this out there. And I think, Michael, it's going to take years, really, to unravel all of these things. I mean, people will write books in due time. But I think to sit here and sort of idly speculate about an interesting but really unprovable at this point theory, not something that I'm capable of doing.
Well, let me ask you about something that you are no doubt capable of, and that is how are these events shaping the Democratic primary?
Well, you know, it's a little hard to say because what we've seen in the past, the trend lines certainly have been positive for Elizabeth Warren. She has continually been growing. She's now either tied or in first place nationally. She's doing very well in the early states, Iowa. She's now tied in New Hampshire with Biden. Bernie Sanders' health problems, she may also ultimately benefit from that. It does sort of freeze things in place. Now, you would think Biden, who has far more international experience than any of these other candidates, would be able to perhaps excel in this sort of environment and talk in ways that would be sophisticated, make sense to voters, show a kind of stability that he could bring to the White House if he were elected president. But, you know, he's gotten embroiled in all this stuff with his son. He took a long time to push back against the president. So we'll see. He right now, his firewall, if you will, is his electoral firewall is African-American voters. And we see in especially South Carolina, which is an early voting state, he is doing very well, especially with older African-Americans. And so we'll see maybe starting tomorrow. Might there be something? I mean, Kamala Harris briefly back in that first debate took a run at Biden and seemed to get some of that African-American support to her. But until he really has a sort of a collapse among black voters, sort of in the way Hillary Clinton did in 2008 when African-Americans decided that, oh, this guy can actually win. I think that, Biden is going to be tough to displace, not impossible by any means. But, you know, I think that that's really where things are. I think the test for these candidates is to continue focusing on the things voters care about. They don't want a president to be distracted, I don't think, by these issues, although there's that hardcore primary voter who does want to see that fire and brimstone aimed at President Trump. So it's a tough sort of a balancing act to carry off.
Well, you know, Jessica Taylor, Scott was right about the short attention span voters have, or maybe we all have as a result of the way news is disseminated. But I was struck by a remark, and I'm sure you recall it, that Vice President Biden made about Elizabeth Warren. It was a bit oblique, but he was saying, you know, we don't need a policy person or words to that effect. In other words, it was actually interpreted as a sexist remark, and I wonder if you could opine on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're of course, I think, going to be the focus of tomorrow night's debate for those of us that are watching. In the first debate, that was the first time, or the last debate, excuse me, last month, that was the first time that they were on stage together once we got this down to one debate. You know, there was a little bit of back and forth at the beginning over their health care plans, but for the rest of it, it was pretty cordial, honestly. And so I think he's going to, you've seen her ascend in the polls even more over the past month. I think he is going to have to sort of take the gloves off and go off against her. But then, I mean, you do sort of run that risk of how does this come off as sexist in a way, too. Biden, his best argument, I think, too, and the one that his team has long made is sort of his electability. And that's, I think, why he has argued that you see the Trump administration going after him and making these sort of overtures to foreign countries.
In that sense, it redounds to his advantage in many ways.
Exactly, because they're worried about him because they see him as the strongest candidate. Because if you look, I mean, he is leading, polls are very early, I will caution, but, you know, he has the ability to be stronger, certainly, in Rust Belt and
But remember President Trump's remarks, he was saying right after that, I predicted that Joe Biden would not be their candidate, and I don't think he's going to be their candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, what comes out of his mouth usually doesn't necessarily approximate truth, but
exactly. Exactly. But I do think that is who Republicans are most worried about. And, Warren, She does have an energy behind her that we did not see Hillary Clinton having early on in 2016, because this sort of fighting for the little guy, this, you know, wanting to take on Wall Street and things. I mean, this was a message that Sanders was able to get energy out of. But I think that she can put policies forward that many people do see as could be plausible, and she has sort of a plan for everything, is sort of the way that people put it. And so we are seeing, I think, this massive energy behind her. I mean, she had 20,000 people in New York, and she's drawing these types of big rallies that that Clinton was never able to, I think, do sort of in the very early parts of the primary. So it does feel like there is that energy behind her.
A lot of that is what they call the likability factor. She just has it much more than former Secretary of State Clinton had.
Yeah, and if I could add, you know, the whole electability, the invincibility of Joe Biden. I mean, if he loses Iowa and or New Hampshire, that electability argument can go up in smoke very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's right. Do we have time for another caller? No, I'm afraid we don't. Let's just close this out by asking, well, it's a big question, but what can we expect may take place in terms of fireworks or in terms of enlightenment in the debate from either of you?
Well, enlightenment, that's a big ask. You know, I think we'll see, does Kamala Harris, our senator, is she going to make a move? She has been stuck in the polls. She's now easily fourth or fifth, down around 5-7%. She has long been expected to try to do something to build on some of the early momentum that she had. We'll see what that looks like. How does Bernie Sanders perform? This will be his first big test after his heart attack. And then, of course, Joe Biden. Will somebody go after him? Will somebody say, look, I wouldn't have my son working for a foreign government or my vice president's son? Will somebody go after him on this issue of Hunter Biden being on the board of a Chinese equity firm and the oil company in Ukraine?
So seconds left. Let me go to you, Jessica, quickly, to look for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Biden's going to come under fire for this. Why they're giving that interview on Tuesday is sort of baffling to me. But for some of these other candidates, Amy Klobuchar is sort of their last chance to make it into the next debate as well, which is going to further winnow
the
field.
We must leave it there. Thank you both so much, Jessica Taylor and Scott Schaefer. In another hour ahead, stay tuned for it. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.